to her hello, she heard Dorothea Harriman's breathless voice saying, "Detective Sergeant Havers?" "If you were expecting someone else, I hate to disappoint," Barbara told her. "So did the earth move?" Dorothea responded in a whisper with, "Word of warning, she's in a twist." "And we're speaking of? Who else? Her nibs. She wants to see you the moment you step onto the premises." "Any idea why?" "It's to do with the Assistant Commissioner. That's all I know. Between you and me, that's all I want to know."
Barbara rang off. A command performance in the DCS's office immediately upon her arrival in Victoria Street did not sound like the manner in which she preferred to start her day. She cursed first and sighed second. Then she put another Pop-Tart into the toaster. Victoria, London. Barbara's options for getting to Victoria Street quickly from Chalk Farm were non-existent. She had a choice between the enduring horrors of street traffic or suffering a ride on the notoriously unreliable Northern Line. But at least with the Northern Line she'd be able to save on the congestion fee, so she got herself from Eaton Villas to the Chalk Farm tube station like an Olympic medalist in the fast walk competition. The wait at the underground station was bad. The crowd that grew on the platform was worse. The ride was worst of all, as the masses of people inside the carriages were a terrorist's dream. They ignored one another as per usual, jostling about like kittens struggling for a nursing position, while also attempting to text, read their newspapers, listen to tinny-sounding music via earbuds, and in one case, eat what smelled like a sardine sandwich. Nearly an hour had passed by the time Barbara reached St. James's Park Station. She dashed to the street and headed towards the looming grey mass of New Scotland Yard, that rose like a barricaded monolith before her. There, she waited impatiently for the security hoo-ha to be completed, a labyrinth of queues, x-rays, more queues, and inspections that every year became more complicated. Finally, she reached the lifts. She was charging towards Isabel Ardrey's office when the DCS opened the door and snapped at Dorothea. "I thought I told you she was to get here directly, so where the hell is she?" And then, before Dorothea could reply, Ardrey spied Barbara and said, "Get in here," before she spun on a heel and went back inside. Barbara exchanged a look with Dorothea. Dorothea murmured, "The Assistant Commissioner was waiting in her office when she got here. Closed doors and massive shouting." Bloody, bleeding hell, was what Barbara thought. She went inside the office, not knowing what to expect and fearing that she was about to come face to face with Hillier at his most Hillier-esque. But the DCS was in the office alone, standing rigidly behind her desk. She barked, "Shut the goddamn door!" And Barbara instantly did so. As she crossed the room, Ardrey took up a filing folder. "Sit," she told her. When Barbara took the chair in front of the DCS's desk, she was apparently close enough to satisfy, because the DCS threw the folder directly at her. "You're finished," she said. "Sign it." Barbara gaped at her. "What's going on?" "Sign it, and get the hell out of my office. Pack up your desk. If you take so much as a paperclip that doesn't belong to you personally, Gov," Barbara cried. "What's going on?" "Don't you bloody say another word. Sign the paperwork and be glad it's only a transfer to the North and not what you deserve, which is to be given the sack, with me making certain that no police force on the planet would ever be willing to take you on, even as a cleaner. Do you understand me?" "No." Barbara could see that something terrible must have happened, but she hadn't the first clue what it might be. She went on with, "I did everything, just like you said, and you even said that I didn't. Barbara couldn't get her mind round what she wanted to say, so flummoxed was she by what was happening. She forced herself to get under control. She said at last, "If you want me to sign, you're going to have to tell me why. Because I know that Hillier was waiting for you, so I know that something has..." "Did you hear me?" Ardrey jerked open the centre drawer of her desk. She pulled out a handful of pens. She threw them at her. "You've crossed the last bloody line with me in your entirely miserable career of crossing lines. You've stepped out of order for the last time you will ever..." "No! What did I do?" "I didn't. I said sign this." Isabel strode round the desk. She grabbed a pen up from the floor. Then she grabbed Barbara's hand and forced her fingers round it. She shoved Barbara's chair closer to the desk. "Now sign! Or is this just another order you intend to disobey? Because you know better, don't you? Because you're some kind of omniscient policing god. Because no matter what you're told to do, or how you're told to do it, or when you're told to do it, or how anything is meant to be done, if you, Barbara Havers, don't happen to agree with it because it is not to your liking and your will, you don't intend to do it. Now sign! But you're not... Stop it!
Barbara pushed her away. She started to rise. Isabel pushed her back down. She shrieked,
I've had enough of you! Everyone here has had enough! Do you actually think you can bring the entire Metropolitan Police Force under a microscope and not be found out? Are you honestly that stupid?
Microscope?
Why won't you tell me?
A voice, entirely unexpected, cut into this, saying, Leave her, Isabel. She did nothing. They both swung round to see that Linley had joined them.
Audrey shouted, Who gave you leave to enter this office? You get the hell back to where you belong. If you do not, this very instant, I'll see you hauled in front of
Barbara didn't do it, Linley said, with that preternatural calm that seemed second nature to the bloke. She doesn't know what you're talking about.
Don't you dare run interference for her.
You can put her on the rack and it won't make a difference, Gov, he said. I'm the one who sent it.
Sent what? Barbara cried. Where? What?
The first report, Linley said. The one you were told to amend by the DCS. I sent it to Clive Druitt, who turned out to be a very easy man to locate. My guess is that he's been to see his MP, and his MP has been to see Hillier. And what's happened is that we've been accused of either a cover-up or a monumental lapse in judgment. And with a look at Audrey, which is it, Gov? Her answer was an icily enraged,
You supercilious bastard! Who the hell do you think you are? Have you any idea at all what you've done?
Instead of replying, Linley said to Barbara, Perhaps it's best if you leave us, Sergeant.
You stay where you are, Audrey said. I'm not finished with you.
Linley had been standing by the door, but now he crossed the room to join them. He and Audrey were eyeball to eyeball. What ran between them would have kept a refrigerator operational for at least a month, Barbara reckoned. As I said, Linley explained in what sounded to Barbara like his most reasonable tone. She had no idea. She gave me the report to read. She was concerned about having been told to exclude part of it. She wanted my opinion. I gave it.
Oh, did you? Audrey said with a sneer. And exactly what would Lord Asherton's high, mighty, and excessively lofty opinion have been?
He told me to do like you told me, Gov, Barbara said hastily, so I revised the report. You read the new one, didn't you? I left out the part about...
Get out! Both of you! Get out!
As Audrey strode behind her desk again, Barbara decided she needed no further invitation from the DCS. She surged to her feet, found herself slipping on one of the pens that Audrey had thrown at her. She felt Linley steady her. She made hasty tracks for the door and was heading for safer climbs as behind her Linley was saying, You've got to see reason, Isabel. If you can't... And as Barbara shut the door, Audrey broke into his words with,
You haven't the first clue what you've done. But that doesn't matter to you, does it? Nothing matters but how you see things, you insufferable piece of upper-class irrelevance.
The door shut now. Linley's response was only a murmur that Barbara couldn't understand. Audrey's next comment was, on the other hand, delivered at maximum volume.
Don't you put that on me! Don't you bloody ever! You think nothing of intruding upon the lives of others because your own life, your own miserable life, who you are and what that's meant to every step you've ever wanted to take.
Another murmur from Linley, which was followed by,
I won't listen to another word of this. Get out before I ring for security. You heard me, didn't you? Have you gone deaf? I said get out!
Barbara dashed away at this. En route, she saw that Dorothea had already done the same thing. Victoria, London. She escaped into the ladies first. Her heart was still pounding so hard that she could feel it hammering against her eardrums. She needed a moment. Two. The entire morning. Whatever. She wished, like the devil, that she could have a fag, but she didn't want to risk it, although on another day she might have done so, bellowing the smoke into the toilet and hoping that continually flushing would suffice to cover her crime, which she knew it would not. But now that seemed like professional suicide in a bowl with whitebait, so instead she ran the water in the basin and thought about dunking her head into its meagre flow.
She was fairly well staggered by what Linley had done. It wasn't the first time he'd put his career out there on the chopping block, but it was definitely the first time he'd done so in such a way that could be interpreted as underhanded. Underhanded was not his style. He was more a bloke who threw down gauntlets in public. Barbara reckoned it came with the title, running through his noblesse oblige blood like he was the Scarlet Pimpernel. She couldn't imagine how the Assistant Commissioner was going to react when he learned that D.I. Linley was behind the original reports being sent to Clive Druitt. Apoplexy came to mind, however. By the time she got herself back to herself in the ladies and had made it to her desk, the entire department was abuzz. Linley had returned and was at his own desk, the door to his office open and the man himself looking as unruffled as she'd ever seen him. She shot a look at her fellow Sergeant Winston and Carter, who cocked his head and shrugged. She went to Linley. He was about to pick up his phone, but he stopped when he saw her in the doorway. One raised eyebrow said, "Yes, Sergeant," in that mild manner she'd come to know. She said,
"Sir, I don't... Why did you do it? This could... I mean, it's not like..."
He half smiled. "I don't think I've ever seen you at a loss for words."
"Then why?"
He lifted a hand and then dropped it. It was one of those born-to-the-purple gestures that he made every so often. It said, "What else could I possibly have done?" But as far as she was concerned, he possibly could have done half a dozen other things. So she said,
"Well?"
His reply was, "Everything needs to come into the light of day, Sergeant. That's all this is. Isabel, the DCS, knows this at heart. Believe me, she does know this." Barbara nodded. She understood. He wasn't talking merely about the two differing reports. Victoria, London. It was just after noon when Linley received the message that he'd known would be coming. He was surprised it had taken so long, as he'd reckoned that once he'd reached his own office, it would be merely a matter of minutes before Judy McIntosh would be giving him the word from on high, a sort of Angel Gabriel without the trumpet. As it was, however, things in Tower Block had apparently begun with the Assistant Commissioner being called upon the carpet inside the Commissioner's office. According to Judy, who served them both and relayed the information to Linley in a modified murmur suitable for the confessional, considerable conversation had taken place between the two men behind the closed door. So she thought it best to do Linley the favour of pretending that he, Linley, was actually not present in Victoria Block when, after his words with the Commissioner, Hillier had barked a demand for D.I. Linley's immediate appearance. She'd reckoned, she informed Linley, that Sir David had needed about an hour to cool off, so she'd only just now informed the A.C. that Dorothea Harriman had finally announced Linley's putative return. So, Judy said in conclusion, if she could possibly tell Hillier that Linley wouldn't at all mind stepping over to Hillier's office, rather soon. Linley said he would be there at once. Isabel would have given Hillier the word, of course. Her feet were doubtless being held to the flames, so Linley couldn't blame her for wanting to pass the joy of the heat along to him. If Hillier was frothing at the mouth and ready to go for her throat, not to mix too many metaphors, Linley thought wryly, there wasn't much else she could do save what she had done, track down the source of the report that had been sent to Clive Druitt. He couldn't blame her. He couldn't even say she'd been in the wrong to tell Havers to eliminate from the official report the information that a gap between an anonymous phone call and an arrest suggested that an investigation into the allegations made against Ian Druitt had, might have, or should have occurred. That fact had not been germane to what had been Isabel's assignment in Shropshire, but it had been germane to the overall issue of someone's death in custody, which was why Linley believed it had needed to be included in Isabel's report. When Linley entered the Assistant Commissioner's office, Hillier jerked his head at a chair, saying only, "Enlighten me, Inspector. I'm trying to work out which part of this entire manure pile we're walking through at the moment represents the worst of the bollocksing up that's gone on in the past several weeks. What's your opinion on the matter?" Hillier was not a man to ask a subordinate's opinion about anything. It was more the type to set off the bomb first and question its accuracy later. Linley knew that the Assistant Commissioner was, thus, waiting for the wrong answer to be issued so that he could take a subsequent action that he'd already decided upon. The difficult part was trying to suss out what that action was going to be. What fell upon his own head was not an anxious issue for Linley. What fell upon Barbara's head was. He said, "You've been told that I posted Barbara's initial report to Clive Druitt."
"Holmes, you amaze me,"
Hillier responded dryly. His narrow-eyed expression did not alter with the words. "I agreed with Dears Havers."
"Are you telling me that posting this report was her idea?"
"I'm not. She didn't bring the matter up. She was concerned about being ordered to alter her report, and she wanted my advice. To give it, I read both the reports. It seemed clear that the 19-day gap between the anonymous call and the arrest of Ian Druitt suggested something that wanted looking into. That was the area of our agreement."
"Indeed,"
Hillier said the word not in acceptance, but rather in assessment of Linley's decision-making process. "Barbara's thinking, and mine as well, was that the IPCC either noted the time gap and decided it wasn't relevant to their investigation, or, what's more likely, they didn't notice the time gap at all. It seemed to me that leaving out that detail had the potential to make the situation far worse than it was already."
"Did it?"
"What, sir?"
"Did it seem that way to you? And if it did, the real question is why you didn't speak to your immediate superior about all of this likely business of yours, which apparently has been plaguing your otherwise tranquil mind."
Hillier folded his hands together on the top of his desk, displaying buffed fingernails and a gold signet ring. He regarded Linley evenly. It came to Linley suddenly how quiet it was inside the Assistant Commissioner's office when the door was closed. There was a church-like silence within. The only sound breaking that silence, when they themselves were not speaking, was the siren of an emergency vehicle down in the street. "She was the one who had given the order, sir. She'd actually left Sergeant Havers no choice in the matter. A man has died in custody."
"Does it astonish you that I already know this?"
Hillier cut in sharply. "And it's my belief that the father of that man deserves a full account of what went on. Or, in this case, what did not go on, which was someone looking into the 19-day gap or even mentioning it. Putting that one detail into the report was all that was ever necessary." Linley could have gone further to point out that Isabel's complete refusal to consider the detail important, or at least to acknowledge its existence, was worrying. But just as he did not want Barbara Havers to have to suffer for a decision that he had made, so also did he not want his actions to have consequences for Isabel. He wasn't reassured at all when Hillier shoved himself away from his desk and stood, looking out of the window behind it. From his own position, Linley could see only the clear blue sky. Hillier would see more, the lushly green tops of the trees that rose above the buildings along Birdcage Walk. Hillier said,
"She's impressively cocked this up."
"You know that, of course."
"Sir, I disagree,"
Linley said quickly. "From the first, she merely wanted to make every point clear so that in the event of solicitors becoming involved—"
"I'm not talking about Havers," Hillier cut in, "although God knows she's the bloody queen of creating cock-ups. And believe me, this has to be a first when it comes down to a question of who cocked up what. No, I'm talking about Ardrey. This is down to her. Something's gone completely to hell with that woman, and we're going to get to the bottom of it."
Linley wasn't enamoured of the plural pronoun, and hoped Hillier was using the royal and oft political "we." He said nothing, waiting for clarification.
"Christ, but I was an idiot to name her permanently to DCS. Sacking her now? What a bloody nightmare that would be. I'd throttle Malcolm if he were only here to present his neck."
Linley followed this train of thought to its logical destination. Malcolm was Malcolm Webberley, who formerly had occupied Isabel's position. His sudden retirement after a hit-and-run accident and Linley's refusal to take on Webberley's job permanently when it was offered to him had placed all of them in the position they occupied now. That position could only be described as precarious. He felt a rush of alarm that his actions might be the cause of Isabel's being sacked. So he said, "Her point was well taken, though." Hillier turned from the window. The light was behind him, now making his expressions more difficult to read.
"Whose?"
he asked.
"DCS Ardrey's.
In her eyes, she and Barbara were in Shropshire solely to look into the IPCC's report. Full stop. The doctored report—"
"Pray God, don't use that term, Inspector. Things are bad enough as it is."
"The second report that Sergeant Havers wrote reflected that. What the DCS's initial orders were." Hillier returned to his chair, sat, fingered a pen on his desk. He said,
You can't have it both ways. Either you're out of order for passing along that initial report, or Ardrey is out of order for having Havers revise it. Which do you choose?
Clever trap, Linley thought. He said, It's a matter of two points of view, sir.
That's your choice?
There isn't a choice. There is no choosing. There is merely reflecting the two points of view. Hillier snorted derisively.
You're a pretty one, aren't you?
Sir?
You've an answer for everything, including this, which has taken a Member of Parliament to the Home Office to register a complaint in advance of God only knows what lawsuit, frivolous or otherwise. I've managed to buy us a 10-day reprieve, but after that, and with no satisfactory result, heads will roll. Do you understand?
Linley wasn't at all happy with where this appeared to be leading.
Satisfactory? He asked. What are we talking about?
We're talking about what you're going to do, Inspector. You didn't actually assume that you could project yourself into this situation without consequences.
Linley then saw where this was going. He knew how well he deserved it. Still, he tried to forestall with, Sir, I've had a holiday cancelled already, because—
Hillier laughed outright.
I'm meant to care about your holiday, am I?
He didn't wait for a reply.
You're going to Shropshire, Inspector Linley. You're going to shovel this pile of manure back into the wheelbarrow it came from. And if you have to use a teaspoon to do it, that's what you're going to use. Is that clear? You're taking Sergeant Havers with you. If together you can't deal with this matter in the next 8 days, allowing one for travel and one for report writing when you return, you'll both be answering for it, as will DCS Ardrey. Am I being clear?
There was nothing for it but what he said.
You are, sir.
Delighted to know it.
You may leave. And I don't want to hear from any of you until this matter is resolved. To my satisfaction, by the way. Certainly not to yours.
May 16th. Ludlow, Shropshire. There didn't seem to be a single area of her life that wasn't fractured. She was like a wall mirror hit by a stone with 100 fault lines cobwebbing out from a single point of contact. This made it so difficult to get up in the morning that there were times when Ding didn't get up at all. And the fact that her undoing had been effected by her own hand resulted in her not having the false respite of being able to blame someone else. She'd made it clear to Brutus that more than one person could engage in the Friends with Privileges life. She'd done so with Finn. She'd been drunk and he'd been stoned, and the whole encounter had been wretched to the absolute extreme. But, as she'd hoped, Brutus met Finn coming out of her bedroom the next morning, and Finn's, "Me too, Brucey," had required no further explanation, since Finn was naked and he'd laughed and thrust his hips forward suggestively. And just in case Brutus didn't understand, he'd also asked, "Ding put out for you like that? Why the hell are you trying to get it someplace else?" That very night, then, Brutus had brought Alison Franklin home. He'd led her up the stairs, and she'd held back, giggling, tittering, whispering, murmuring, whatevering her faux reluctance, even as she'd cast a triumphant glance into the sitting room, where Ding was trying to get rid of the snow on the ancient television she'd brought back months ago from Cardew Hall. Finn was supposedly helping her, which was all about a running commentary having to do with girls, technology, and demands that she let him see to it, for fuck's sake, Ding! Ding heard the front door open. She heard it close, and then she heard Alison Franklin's breathless, "I can't, Bruce. Really, she's here, isn't she?" She tried to ignore this, but it was impossible, especially with Finn saying loudly, "Keep the orgasmic howling to a minimum, you lot, and we'll do the same," as Brutus led Alison towards the stairs. Ding's eyes met Brutus's eyes. His expression was blank, and she made hers indifferent. Up the stairs the two of them went. They didn't come down them till the following morning. She hadn't expected this to be so excruciating. Distracting herself seemed like the only option. The easiest distraction available turned out to be the one that came knocking on her bedroom door nearly every night following the first one, each time she let Finn in. And she did things to him that kept him coming back for more. After the third time, Brutus confronted her. They weren't at home. She was in Castle Square on her way to a lecture. That, luckily, gave Brutus very little time to say what he wanted to say. It was this. "I got to talk to you, okay?" And without pausing for her to reply, because obviously he could see her face hardening, and anyway, even if he couldn't,
He knew how reluctant she would be even to say hello.
"You've made your point."
"What point?" She aimed for sounding arch.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"If it's me and Finn..."
"There isn't any you and Finn. Not like there's a you and me. You've got some bloody nerve. Come on, Ding. What you're doing with Finn, it isn't even who you are."
She wanted to shove him onto his bum at that. She wanted to kick his shins and do everything else an 8-year-old would do, because Brutus knew her better than anyone, and she hated him for it.
"We are friends with privileges," she told him, "me and Finn, and I can't see it's any of your business."
"Don't be an idiot, Ding. You know you're doing this to get at me. I fuck Allison, so you're fucking Finn. You wouldn't even be doing it with him if you didn't know Allison and I were doing it."
"Oh, that's how you see it? You're inside my head? Or is it just that what you do can't apply to anyone else?"
"It can apply wherever it wants to apply." He shifted his weight, and he ran the heel of his palm back through his tousled hair. He was, as always, dressed like a male model, so it was little wonder that it took no effort for him to pull girls.
"It's just that... Look, it's not like I don't like you, Ding. I mean, like you, as in really like you. I do. But the rest of it? The exclusive bit? I keep trying to tell you it's not how I'm made. I just need more."
"Oh, I got that," she told him.
"I discovered it's not how I'm made either. I suppose I owe you for that, don't I? There's lorries full of advantages in spreading the joy all round, and I would never have worked that out if you hadn't shoved that cow Allison down my throat."
"Whoops.
Not exactly right, is that? It's your tongue you were shoving down her throat, and the rest of you you were shoving someplace else."
He made an expression of distaste, saying, "See, even that, it's not you. You're not like that. Let's call a truce."
"You don't know what I'm like." Her voice rose. "You want a truce, but what you really want is me just waiting, hanging about, hoping you get tired of her, so you'll maybe come back and do me the favour of being your team side fuck, so you don't have to go to the trouble of bringing Allison home."
"That's not true." Brutus blushed, however, so Ding knew how closely she'd hit the mark.
"Oh, right," she said. "Which part of it, Brutus? Now, don't even answer. The trouble isn't bringing Allison home to fuck, is it? The real problem is waving her off afterwards. You can't get rid of her the way you want to. Isn't that it?"
She laughed. Even to her ears it sounded a little hysterical, but she felt the triumph of knowing she was correct.
"Oh, God, it must be a total nightmare. She's expecting to spend the night, and you're expecting her to dress and be gone, only you can't actually tell her that, can you? Thanks for the shag, darling. Now, if you don't mind, what a problem you've got."
She expected him to stalk off after that, but he didn't do so. Instead, he watched her, and he waited till she was finished. Then he said, "You can't work out what that means, can you?"
"What?"
she said.
What means, Brucey?"
"That I stayed."
"Where?"
"With you.
In your room. All night. In bed. I stayed because you're different. You're not one of the others. I stayed because I cared. I care."
But there was something not right in his voice. Ding could hear it, just the edge of something very close to panic, so bloody close. She knew then exactly why he was talking to her there in Castle Square. She bloody knew what he wanted from her and how he was lying in order to get it. She kept her fury going for the rest of that day. She knew she would need it in order to do what she'd decided to do. When she arrived back at the house in Teamside, she went to her room. She dragged out of the cupboard what she'd tried and failed to toss into a wheelie bin 9 days earlier. She'd got as far as holding the two articles over a pile of smelly rubbish, but she couldn't do it. She'd wanted to, she'd seen the necessity, but at the final moment she'd stayed her own hand. She could keep them hidden away, she told herself. Surely she'd be able to wear them again one day, wouldn't she? Now she opened the carrier bag into which she'd folded the skirt and the spangly top. She removed them, spread them lovingly on the bed. Then she waited. When Brutus came home, she heard his entrance because once again he brought that simpleton Allison with him. She could hear the murmurs and the quiet laughter, no giggling this time, and the pause for a prefatory snog in the corridor, and then the door of his room, and how it opened and closed, and that was what she was anticipating. She gathered up the clothing. She strode to his room. She didn't knock. She opened the door, threw the clothing inside, and said,
"I protected you, so do what you bloody want with this."
Then she saw that Alison Franklin wasn't the girl Brutus had brought home this time. It was Francie Adamucci, all bright-eyed and on her knees, her hands in the act of unzipping his trousers.
"Ding!"
Francie said with a laugh as she went about the business she'd been engaged in.
Want to join us?
Hindlip, Herefordshire. Every tedious part of her earlier trip to West Mercia headquarters was repeated. Barbara and Linley began with the interminable wait at the distant reception building, made just long enough to challenge their patience. Then came the drive to the headquarters' main building, past all the CCTV cameras and through the expanse of open land. After that, there was a break in the action for something new, as Linley sought a parking bay that was suitably distant from all other vehicles. This was done, Barbara knew, to preserve the £1 million paint job, copper in colour and every inch of it polished lovingly by hand, on his motor. Following that, however, the former process resumed. They were made to wait in the reception hall while Chief Constable Wyatt proved to them that the Met was as unwelcome today as the Met had been before. After 10 minutes, however, Linley put an end to the wait. Approaching the enormous reception counter, he said to one of the civilians there, "The Chief Constable has more than made his point. Now, as my detective sergeant is quite familiar with the route to his office, you can let him know we're on our way up, or we can surprise him. It's entirely up to you, Sergeant." He nodded towards the stairway. Barbara beat a happy path there, while behind her she heard first a protest and then a hasty phone call being made, after which a voice cheerfully called out,
"Oh yes, do go up. The Chief Constable is expecting you."
At that point she was already at the top of the stairs, with Linley just behind her. She went to the same grand doors she'd been through before. This time one of them stood open, and as she went through it, C.C. Patrick Wyatt was coming across the room in her direction. His face was granite. He said, "See here," to which Linley replied with, "We can agree at once, Chief Constable. You've no time for us, we've no time for you. Shall we get on with it, or argue who's more affronted by this situation?" Ooh, Barbara thought, he was using the voice. He really did that because he knew that when it came to being a duck out of water, he was the duck, and it didn't make any sense to emphasize that. But every so often such emphasis was necessary, and the voice was required. Upon hearing it, the other paused in surprise. It was the pause that Linley sought. Into it he said, "We're not here to make your people look bad, sir, and we're certainly not here because we volunteered. The IPCC overlooked a detail when they investigated your Ludlow situation, and our job is to get to the bottom of that. Our presence has nothing at all to do with your force, and everything to do with the IPCC." Well, Barbara thought, this wasn't entirely true, but it did the job of catching the CC off guard, adding to what the voice had started. Instead of putting him on a defensive footing, the CC was now at least partially disarmed. "Go on." Wyatt made no move to usher them farther into the office, but his granite face altered just round the eyes and his head turned a fraction as he unconsciously presented them with more of his ear. Linley said, "May I?" But he didn't wait for permission to shut the door. He didn't ask to sit, as this would give the CC an opportunity to refuse him. Barbara took careful note of the nature of this pissing contest. She kept her mouth shut because between herself and Linley she knew which one of them was the bull, and this particular shop was filled with a kind of porcelain she was only too expert at smashing to bits. They needed to know, Linley explained to Wyatt, exactly who did what and when during 19 days that had stretched between the paedophile call made from the Ludlow police station and the arrest of the deacon of St. Lawrence Church. 19 days comprised quite enough time for at least a cursory look into the allegations made against Ian Druitt, but the IPCC had made no mention of any look at all. What could Chief Constable Wyatt tell them about that period of 19 days? Learning that the Met was making a second incursion into his patch, the Chief Constable had apparently prepared himself for this meeting, but he had little enough information to share. The IPCC had mentioned nothing in their report about an investigation, because there had been no investigation. Had the anonymous call constituted information about a possible murder, the matter would have been taken differently. But this was a single call about a clergyman who had only just been given a public award in Ludlow. The call centre operator had done exactly what was required, logged the call in. When the log was read by the officer on duty, that officer made a judgment that anyone would have made. It was a crank call phoned in by someone who either was jealous or had an axe to grind with Ian Druitt. "But surely you're not saying paedophilia is something that goes disregarded?" Linley said. "Of course not," Wyatt replied, "but absent the ghost of a whisper of wrongdoing, other than a phone call made, by the way, to the wrong calling centre, which is another matter entirely, have you a suggestion as to what the force was supposed to do?" Wyatt went on to tell them that the closest manned station in Shrewsbury could have brought Druitt in for questioning immediately, yes. But failing a lengthy investigation into what appeared to be a nasty crank phone call,
Such questioning would have consisted of, "What do you have to say about this, sir?" to which Druitt would have replied, "It's absolute rubbish." After that, if there was sufficient manpower, which there was not, officers might have begun the process of interviewing every man, woman, and child with whom the clergyman had come into contact in the years he'd been part of St. Lawrence Parish. "But the fact is that we don't have the manpower," Wyatt concluded. "What we do have is a single murder squad in the area, and they're responsible for assaults, rape, and every other violent crime that happens on their patch. We're meant to make do. So I hope you see why an anonymous message about a deacon from St. Lawrence Church would fall rather low on the list." They did, of course. But there remained the small matter of the arrest of Ian Druitt 19 days later. If there had been no investigation based on the message, why had he been arrested at all? "You must admit," Linley pointed out, "something more must have come up. What my sergeant was able to learn from the PCSO in Ludlow..."
"Gary Raddock," Barbara added.
Wyatt shot her a look. She was undeterred.
"He told me he got the order from his sergeant. But his sergeant would have got the order from somewhere else. Especially if there wasn't ever an investigation, right?"
"Have you any idea who gave that order to the PCSO's sergeant?" Linley asked. "I try not to micromanage, Inspector. I've told you what I can. Any more information will need to come from the PCSO's sergeant. Since she gave the order to pick up the clergyman, only she can tell you what prompted her to do so."
"Her name?" was Linley's next question.
She was called Geraldine Gunderson, and the Met officers could get the rest of her details from reception. Much Wenlock, Shropshire. Havers lit a cigarette as they walked from the main headquarters building to the Healy Elliot. She began sucking down the smoke like someone determined to enjoy her final moments before execution.
"The more I learn about what's gone on, the less makes sense," she said from within a cloud of smoke. 19 days without an investigation, and then the bloke's arrested. You ask me, someone knows something, and I expect that someone is sitting behind us in that building."
She jerked her thumb back over her shoulder.
"And whatever it is, no one wants the Met to dig it up."
Linley couldn't entirely disagree. Irregular didn't begin to describe the arrest and subsequent death of the deacon of St. Lawrence Church, Ludlow. But as to the what, the who, and the why of it all, he had difficulty assigning any of those to West Mercia headquarters. He said, "I wouldn't want to be in the CC's position. The cutbacks he is coping with are bad enough. On top of that, he's been saddled with a death in custody, which he assumes the IPCC have investigated and found unfortunate but not criminal. He thinks that's the end of it. Then suddenly the Met turns up in the person of you and the DCS. He goes through that, thinks it's finished, and then he learns the Met's to arrive a second time. He digs up everything he can and tells us what he knows. But we still have questions that he can't answer. It's pressure on pressure. One can't blame him for wanting it to end." They reached the car and stood on either side of it while Havers finished her fag. She said,
"I'm chuffed you can be so philosophical, sir, especially since you've lost your holiday in Cornwall for a second time."
He looked beyond her, towards an activity ongoing that appeared to involve police cadets and riot gear, which was not an especially reassuring sight. He said, "Yes, well, it wasn't shaping up to be the holiday of my dreams anyway."
"Things not going swimmingly in the relationship department?"
"Deirdre's become something of an expert at coming up with excuses." Havers tossed the fag on the ground and tramped on it.
"What do you reckon she thinks you have in mind, taking her to Cornwall? Planning to dump her down one of those abandoned mines you lot have scattered around the countryside?"
"That could be what concerns her, I admit," Linley said wryly. He unlocked the car. They both climbed in. When they were buckled up and he turned on the ignition, Havers said,
"As ever, sir, you've got your work cut out. I mean, it's not like I don't keep saying."
"You do. But I remain ever sanguine.
One of your finer qualities. But can I just say..."
"Since you will, anyway," Linley noted.
"It's only that not everyone wants to end their days in Cornwall, inside someone's ancestral home with 300 rooms.
"Helen Stowe's hardly that, Barbara."
"Perhaps not. But I expect you've got a whopping great gallery with a few 100 years of Linley's hanging there looking like they smell something nasty."
"I'd hardly call it whopping great."
"Ha! I knew you lot would have a gallery."
Linley cast her a look and knew she would read it as he intended, something she would undoubtedly call one of his "see here, sergeant" expressions. He said to her, "It's not as if I'm proposing marriage, Barbara, but it's been over a year for us now, and I merely thought Deirdre might at some point in time like to meet my mother, and the others, of course."
Who would those be? The butler and the scullery maids?
We have only day help, Sergeant, and not even every day at that, unfortunately. Aside from the butler, of course, and while I'd very much like to apologise for his presence, he's nearly 150 years old, and no one quite remembers who hired him. To force him out into the street now in order not to offend someone's republican sensibilities seems rather like an act of cruelty.
Very funny, sir.
You can make a joke, but what I'm saying is that she probably reckons it's some bloody test. For all you know, she thinks you want to see if she knows which of the 25 forks she's meant to use on her sausage and mash. Not that you'd let sausage and mash pollute your fine china course.
Not that I would, he noted. So, what then? You're planning to just soldier on in that department?
Soldiering on appears to be what I do best. They left the grounds of West Mercia headquarters, with Havers using the huge A to Z, which Linley preferred to any other method of navigation. He liked to have a sense of the countryside through which they were driving, something that a smartphone's GPS wouldn't ever give him. Havers groused about this, as she would do, but she settled in. She managed to get them to the small town of Much Wenlock without a single wrong turn, although admittedly things got a bit iffy in Kidderminster's town centre, where she forced him to circle a roundabout three times since she couldn't take in the road signs quickly enough to make a directional decision. But they finally made it to their destination, finding themselves in another of the county's picturesque towns, a medieval place of half-timbered and timber-framed buildings, begging for tourists to aim cameras in their direction, as well as a few ranges of perfectly proportioned Georgian homes. The age of the town was suggested by its ancient guild hall, which stood upon enormous oak pillars, and rested above what had once been the prison. It was a building of timber and plaster, of gables and mullioned windows, and beneath it the iron staples of a whipping post suggested justice that had been swift and bleak. The address they had for Sergeant Geraldine Gunderson was, as one would expect in such a place where the postman was expected to know everyone by name, less than crystalline. It involved the number 3, the identifying location as the farmhouse and near the priory, which completed the given information. The priory was easy enough to find since it was an historic ruin, and the routes to historic ruins were generally well marked, so that the curious might investigate, but even then following the signs to it did not actually reveal any part of the great abbey itself, since it was sheltered not only by a stone wall, but also by banks of limes and beeches and cedars that would have made it difficult for even Cromwell to find. But past it and down a secondary lane so narrow that Linley winced at the danger to the Healy Elliot's wings, they came upon what was posted the farmhouse, which turned out to be quite a large building of ancient vintage, timber-framed and subdivided into respectably sized cottages. Conveniently, these were numbered, so all that was required was finding a space to park where the car would be most sheltered from passing tractors. Once this was accomplished, with Havers going on in her usual fashion about the 250 yards they had to hike back to the farmhouse from the narrow lay-by that Linley found, they made fairly easy contact with Sergeant Gunderson. Her part of the subdivided farmhouse was the most tumble-down, its appearance suggesting this state mostly because of an ill-kept garden in the front that had long ago waved the white flag to a wisteria never trained to do anything but choke each piece of vegetation that had tried to gain a foothold there. They tramped through this to the front door, where an iron knocker had rusted nearly through. There was no bell, so the knocker and a good few whacks on the unpainted wood were the only means of alerting someone that visitors had come to call. A tall, harried-looking woman answered. She said, "You're the Met, I presume," and added, "Come this way, then. I'm in the midst," and she left them to enter, to close the door and to follow her along a stone-floored corridor that took them into a dining-room. There a massive piece of bright green fabric had been thrown on a table, with part of it being attached to an elongated form made from chicken wire. A scissors, a stapler, and a roll of sellotape were all being used to effect the fabric's attachment, while the same implements had already been applied to a large piece of polystyrene, shaped not unlike an Elizabethan ruff. It was now covered with a layer of bubble wrap, while yellow fabric, dotted in pink, appeared to be waiting to cover this. She said, frankly, "Yes, well, I'm complete crap at sewing, but did my eldest raise her hand and shout, 'My mummy will,' when the teacher asked who might be the hookah-smoking caterpillar? Afternoon tea, this is. One of those blasted school fundraisers that they have every time one turns round. For this one, if you can believe it, the servers will be characters from Alice in Wonderland, or perhaps it's Through the Looking Glass. I have no clue there. I suppose I should be happy Miriam didn't raise her hand and volunteer me to bake tarts or whatever, because the one thing I actually do worse than sewing is baking. But on the other hand, I could have bought the tarts. Where on earth could I buy a caterpillar costume?
The hookah was simple. One can order them off the internet. No surprise there, but it was a surprise to discover that a caterpillar costume could not be had for love or money.
You're Sergeant Gunderson, Linley verified.
Oh, sorry, of course. But it's Jerry, if you will.
Linley introduced himself and Havers, and Jerry Gunderson said that she was happy enough to take a break from the wretched sewing exercise because she was close to losing her mind and even closer to seriously abusing her eldest daughter when she next walked through the front door. She offered them fresh lemonade. She warned them that it's rather tart, as I don't use much sugar. But both Linley and Havers indicated that they were willing to have a go. Gunderson then recommended that they sit outside, in the back of the place, as she put it, adding that since the day was fine, and as long as they didn't mind chickens, they could all enjoy the good weather. They agreed to this as well, and she led them from the dining room through a neatly kept kitchen to a door leading out to the back of the cottage. There are 7 chickens pecked at the ground, while 2 more roosted on the round wooden table whose chairs were tufted with years of lichen. They were advised, "No worries, that won't come off on your clothing at this time of year, and I rather like it," regarding the lichen. The chickens were shooed away. Gunderson told them that she'd be with them presently, and in the meantime they were to enjoy whatever, she said with a wave of her hand. Linley wasn't sure what she meant. The chickens, the lichen, the condition of the garden, which had mostly been taken over by the fowl, or the swelling of a hillside in the distance, where a coppice of what seemed to be hornbeams had created a smallish woodland long gone without maintenance. Gunderson wasn't away from them long enough for either of them to make a decision about what they intended to enjoy. She banged into the cottage and then banged out of the cottage. She carried a large baking pan in lieu of a tray. On it she'd assembled the offered lemonade. Linley considered Gunderson as she deposited the refreshments. There was virtually nothing English about her save her accent, which was English Midlands through and through. Otherwise she looked foreign, with her olive skin, coal-coloured hair and deeply brown eyes. She had a nose reminiscent of Italian noblemen. She threw herself into a chair, watched them each take a sip of her lemonade, and said, "Well, can you stand it?"
"Not bad at all," Havers replied.
Gunderson looked pleased at this, and Linley took a sip of his. It turned out to be mostly water, for which he was grateful, considering Gunderson's remark about sugar. He then explained what they were doing in Shropshire. Gunderson said,
"Oh, God, I know, I know. I don't need my memory jogged about what happened."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning the night in March that put all of us on this road. It's not likely I'll ever forget it, Inspector."
"Thomas," he said.
"Thomas," she agreed.
"What can you tell us about that night?" As Linley asked the question, Havers removed her notebook and a pencil. She'd switched, Linley saw, to the sort of pencil Carter used, mechanical. He was duly impressed. Gunderson went through the night for them. She confirmed what Havers had written in her report regarding the Shrewsbury patrol officers who were in the midst of dealing with a series of house and shop burglaries, and were thus unavailable to fetch Ian Druitt from Ludlow. She also indicated that she knew nothing of any investigation that might have been done into the accusation of paedophilia prior to the order to fetch Druitt. She said she'd only learned, after the man had offed himself in custody, as she put it, that this rotten mess had begun with an anonymous phone call. That, she told them, had been a real jaw-dropper for her. Essentially, she didn't know what anyone had been thinking and what the bloody hell had been going on. She added, "Look, some of that's my fault. I've said that to my gov."
"How so?" Havers was the one to ask. "My husband's in hospital. Colon cancer. He's going to survive, but it's been hell. My mind occasionally goes elsewhere, and it certainly might have done on that night. All the same, my remit is merely to be responsible for the PCSOs in the area. I was told to pass on the order about Druitt to our Ludlow officer, and that's what I did. I didn't ask why, as there was no reason to. Like you, I expect, I obey an order when it's given."
Linley chose not to disabuse her of her conclusion, since Havers was not the only Met officer present who'd ignored an order in the past. Instead, he asked her where the order to have the Ludlow PCSO fetch Ian Druitt had come from. He was surprised by her answer.
"From headquarters," she said.
He looked at Havers. She looked at him. Her expression answered his unspoken question. Headquarters giving anyone orders about anything had not been mentioned before this moment. He said, "From whom, exactly?"
"The DCC," Gunderson replied. "Deputy Chief Constable," Havers clarified.
Linley added, "We've met C.C. Wyatt, but no one else connected to headquarters. He said nothing about a DCC. Gunderson didn't seem to find this unusual. She lifted her lemonade, took a swig, and said,
"Don't know a damn thing about that, do I?
All I can tell you is the DCC rang me and gave me the word. Have Ludlow's PCSO take a bloke called Ian Druitt to the local station and wait for the Shrewsbury officers to fetch him up to the custody suite there. That's what she wanted, and that's what I did. I rang Gary Ruddock, that's the PCSO, and gave him the word.
She, Havers said.
What?
You said she in reference to the DCC, Linley pointed out.
May we have her name?
Oh, right, sorry, Jerry Gunderson said. She's called Freeman, Clover Freeman. I took the order from her.
Much Wenlock, Shropshire.
Something's not right, sir.
Havers paused just outside the door of Geraldine Gunderson's part of the ancient farmhouse. She did the depressingly expected. She fished in her shoulder bag to bring forth a packet of players. She lit up. Linley wanted to ask her for the umpteenth time when she planned to kick the habit, as he was becoming quite concerned about the impact on her health. He refrained, however. She would only point out that the sanctimony of the former smoker was as bad as an erstwhile atheist's banging on about his moment of coming to Jesus. So instead he said, "Which part of it?" aside from the sergeant's sewing skills. They proceeded through the mini jungle of wisteria and made it unscathed to a narrow lane where a sudden kawit, kawit striking the air suggested partridges were nearby. Havers puffed away. She said,
"Oh, she's got her work cut out there. It wasn't looking like any caterpillar I've ever seen."
Linley said dryly, casting a look in her direction, "So if it's not Sergeant Gunderson's sewing?"
"It's this. We were just slapped on the side of the head by a bloody interesting coincidence. The DCC Gunderson told us about. The one who rang her up with the order to fetch Ian Druitt to the police station."
"Clover Freeman," Linley said.
"Happens she's not the only Freeman the governor tripped over in Shropshire, sir."
She took another lungful of smoke. This one was deeper than the others. Really, Linley thought, she desperately needed to take the cure. He said, "Who's the other?"
"I never met him. The Gov did the honours, but he's called Finnegan Freeman, and he was a helper at this after-school kids' club that Druitt ran. Far as I know, when Ardrey questioned him, he didn't say word one to her about having a relation in the police force."
"Perhaps she's not a relation. Freeman isn't an unusual name.
Not like Stravinsky."
"Right." He lifted an eyebrow. "Sergeant, you continue to impress."
"Couldn't have a note. That came out of nowhere."
"Alas," he said, "but do go on."
"My point is, assuming his mum and this DCC Freeman are one and the same, or saying she's just his auntie or something, or even his gran, it seems to me he would have mentioned it when DCS Ardrey had a word with him. Deputy Chief Constable, that outranks Ardrey by a long chalk. A London copper shows up at his door to have a word or two, and why wouldn't he mention on the by-and-by that he's got his own copper up his sleeve?"
"Assuming they're related, would he have a reason to do that?"
"To shake Ardrey up. To put her on the wrong foot. To get her worried about dealing rough with him. But he didn't do that, and I wonder why."
She was silent for a moment, examining the tip of her player and rolling it between her fingers. "Again, there might be no relation between them."
"Right, unless there is. Unless he did tell her, and she didn't mention it to me for some reason."
Linley knew Havers well enough to catch the underlying point she was making. He said, "Because she wanted to get back to London, and she knew that a DCC related to someone she was speaking to made things more complicated." It threw a bone into the pack of dogs, so to speak.
"Not that I like the comparison much."
"Sorry," he said. "It was inadvertent, and more metaphor than simile, if we want to get technical. As to DCS Ardrey deliberately overlooking something that might be crucial."
"It's possible, isn't it? If she was hot to get back to town and she told me about this Freeman thing, sir, she'd have known I'd want to shake that nut like a squirrel in a tree."
And when he glanced in her direction, she added,
I know, squirrels don't shake nuts, but you catch my meaning."
"It's curious," was all that Linley was willing to offer her. They reached the Healy Elliot and leaned against it while Havers finished up the fag. One side of the car bordered a hedge taller than Linley. The other opened onto a field where ripening wheat grew so precisely laid out, it was as if the hand of God had applied shears to the height of it. A breeze rustled it. A deep blue sky banked with cumulus clouds hung above it in contrast to its golden hue. Havers tossed the dog end of the player onto the ground at last and saw to it with the toe of her shoe. She said,
"It looks like something more to me."
And he knew she was referring to the issue of coincidence.
"Say she's a relative of this kid Finnegan. If she is, Could be she knew there might be some truth to what that anonymous call said about the paedophilia bit. Or at least that she thought there could be truth to it. And she wanted to find out pronto because her son, nephew, grandson, whatever, worked with the bloke and might end up involved.
Linley considered this as he unlocked the car and they climbed inside. When he had the engine engaged, he said, the son, nephew, grandson himself could have made the call.
Right, and say this kid's a relation of hers. He stumbles on something,
Havers said meditatively.
Something he sees. Something he hears.
He witnesses something directly, Linley offered.
Or one of the kids in the after-school club tells him something. He can't believe it, but he checks it out, and he has to believe it then. But the last thing he wants is to be marked as a grass. What kid wants that? And he's still a kid, according to Ardrey. So he uses that intercom outside the Nick in Ludlow, and he does it anonymously. All he knows is that what's going on has to stop, but nothing happens. So then what? He tells his mum, or his aunt, or his gran, or whoever this DCC Freeman might be, and she sets the wheels in motion.
That does play out, doesn't it?
Except the Gov said that he was hot, bothered and righteous when the subject of Druitt diddling children came up. Of course, that could have been all for show, I reckon, because he'd have to be heavy with the righteous protecting of Druitt so the gaff wouldn't be blown, the gaff being the fact that he was the person grassing up Druitt in the first place, eh?
Linley took all of this on board as he managed a three-point turn farther along the lane and then headed them back in the direction of the village. It seemed to him that it was time to track down DCC Clover Freeman in order to get her side of the tale that concluded with the death of an Anglican deacon. While he drove, Havers tracked the DCC. She began with West Mercia headquarters, reporting back to him that Clover Freeman had left for the day. She managed to get the DCC's mobile number off the Chief Constable's secretary after explaining it was a matter of some urgency that the Met coppers speak with her personally, since they sorted out her involvement in the matter of the death of Ian Druitt. Reaching those last five words was as far as she'd needed to go. Linley murmured, "Nice work," as he followed the route into the village and pulled over when they were in view of the timber-framed guild hall, where a woman with a selfie stick was grinning into her mobile and, he reckoned, ruining an otherwise lovely picture of the town's most photographed building. He listened idly to Havers's half of the conversation, which appeared to consist of a negotiation with the DCC, who seemed to think this matter of speaking with the Met officers could wait till tomorrow, especially since she herself was en route to her home. Some back-and-forthing happened next, during which Havers was all courtesy with her, "No, ma'ams," and "It's necessary, ma'ams," and "We can easily come to you, ma'ams." The result was an agreement that, considering the hour, she and Linley would come along to the DCC's home in Worcester, after having an early dinner themselves at some point. They would arrive at the DCC's home round 8:30. If the DCC would text her address, "Thank you, ma'am." When Havers ended the call, she said to Linley, "She'll be waiting for us, but she won't be happy." "I did get that impression," he told her. Worcester, Herefordshire. When Trevor Freeman returned from his walk with the rambling rogues, he took an evaluative look at his hiking boots. They wouldn't do, he decided. They were far too clean. Along with his hiking sticks, he accomplished what needed to be accomplished in the back garden, where he used the hosepipe and the herbaceous border that was not a herbaceous border at all, but rather a dug-up and eternally uncultivated rectangle of earth running along the fence. There he created a nice pool of muck and stirred it about with one of his sticks, achieving a fine goo into which he plopped his boots. He wrestled them round a bit, and when they were sufficiently filthy, he returned to the front of the house, where he placed both boots and sticks in extremely plain sight. Inside the house, he went for his mobile. He hadn't taken it with him while he was out with the rambling rogues, because mobile phones were verboten. The group leader was allowed one, of course, but only for use in cases of emergency. Should one of the older members of the rogues have a heart attack or a stroke, the club did not wish to see him languishing away for want of a device of communication. When he took his mobile from the worktop, Trevor saw that he'd missed four calls while he'd been gone. Three of them were from Clover. The fourth had come from Gaz Ruddock. Trevor went for Clover's first and was struck at once by what she asked him. Could Trev phone Gaz Ruddock? Would he invite him to dinner for tomorrow night? Trevor went on to her second. Had Trev managed to make contact with Gaz Ruddock yet? Was he coming for a meal? And finally, why wasn't Trev returning her calls? Trevor found all of this mystifying and, frankly, a little troubling. Why, he wondered, had Clover not merely phoned Gaz Ruddock herself?
Since she had the time to ring her husband on three occasions while he'd been with the rogues, why not just make the phone call she was asking him to make? He pondered this as he opened the fridge and brought forth a bottle of fizzy water. He drank it down, tried to come up with an answer, failed to do so, felt a twinge of disquiet, but phoned the PCSO as requested. He caught Gaz at the market, picking up some staples along with the ingredients to put together Spag Bol for dinner that night. Before Trevor could extend the invitation that Clover wished him